Okay.
Good evening, everyone. I'd like to call this meeting to order. Can I get a roll call?
Mrs. Avalos?
Here.
Mr. Davis?
Here.
Mrs. DeGracius?
Here.
Mrs. Hickey?
Here.
Mr. Moore?
Here.
Dr. Thompson and Ms. Williams are not here.
And we generally recognize visitors and invite comments.
There's no one signed up to speak unless they sign the wrong. Nope, we're good.
Okay, so the next business is to, I need a motion to nominate Secretary Pro Tem. A motion to nominate.
I nominate Barb Hickey.
She's already.
She's committed.
A motion.
Could we nominate Judy?
Nice try, Bob.
Here, why don't you nominate Judy?
I nominate Judy.
Okay, does anyone have a second for that?
Second.
Hold on a second, now I'm all flustered here.
Thank you, Katie.
You were my first choice.
Okay, is there a motion?
A motion.
And I second.
Okay, hold on.
To nominate Judy.
Mr. Moore?
Yes.
Mrs. Hickey?
Yes.
Mrs. DeGracius?
Yes.
Mr. Davis?
Is this our vote?
Yeah.
Okay, yes.
All right, and Mrs. Avalos?
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead.
Must be November. All right, I need a motion to approve tonight's agenda.
So moved.
Second.
Mrs. Avalos?
Yes.
Mr. Davis?
Yes.
Mrs. DeGracius?
Yes.
Mrs. Hickey?
Yes.
Mr. Moore?
Yes. Any communications that Stacy would have?
Yes, the Secretary Pro Tem will read the communications.
That would be.
One thing.
We have a thank you letter from Brenda Latsky and her family. Dear to Dr. Conan and the Board of Education, thank you so much for the absolutely gorgeous flowers sent in memory of my dear dad. My dad was a lifelong educator, professor at Concordia, who inspired our entire family to become educators as well. I feel truly honored to teach in District 90, surrounded by such a supportive and caring community. Thanks again, Brenda Latsky and family.
The next item is a Freedom of Information Act request.
Yes, we did have three FOIA requests, excuse me, this month. The first was from Ms. Holstein from Canon Solutions. She was requesting information regarding the district's copiers and lease agreements. We had a Freedom of Information request from Jonathan P. Fagg, Ms. Pistone, and Ms. DeLoyan regarding records of vaping-related incidents in our school district. And we had a request from Mr. Steve Lefko requesting information about the five essential survey results for Roosevelt, Willard, and Lincoln for the five surveys prior to 2017. We were able to respond to all of them as per time limit.
As you always do. Thank you very much. And next item was student
presenters. Yes, so it was student presenters. We share regrets with our guests who are here tonight and with the board. We had three Roosevelt students who had been preparing a performance for you, a song, and for a couple of reasons, unfortunately, they're unable to perform tonight. So they send their regrets, but they were to do that in honor of board appreciation. So think of the most beautiful song you could have heard. That's what you would have heard. They really felt terrible about not being able to join.
Well, you can't rush genius.
You
so
can't.
Please tell them.
We will invite them to the next opportunity. Absolutely.
Every day is board appreciation day.
Next item is to approve the consent, a motion to approve the consent agenda.
So moved.
Second.
Mr. Moore?
Yes.
Mrs. Hickey?
Yes.
Mrs. DeGracius?
Yes.
Mr. Davis?
Yes.
Mrs. Avalos?
Yes.
Board committee reports. Was there an education committee meeting?
The next meeting is Thursday.
Okay,
education
committee. Community council?
Per Personnel?
Yes, I went last.
Oh, I'm sorry, personnel. We're doing board committees first, my fault, sorry.
Okay.
Was you personnel for Barb?
I don't believe we have a report, do we?
We don't this evening.
Not tonight.
Nothing in the board packet for policy?
No, we just received the materials and we'll be, Stacy and I will be meeting in December.
Great. Finance, Cal?
Banks and bills, treasury reports, let's see, we're gonna talk about the levy, transfer some funds from the township, and I think we're gonna have our new finance-friendly part of the website explained in the superintendent's report.
Okay, great. And equity committee, is there, we had a report out last week.
We'll reconvene in January.
Next meeting's in January. Inclusiveness, I'm sorry, board liaison, I'm gonna go way back here. Youth. I apologize. Equity, facilities. Judy, facilities?
Nothing to report at this time.
Katie, communications?
We have a meeting scheduled for early December. I don't remember the date, but it's like December 5th or something.
Okay, ad hoc gender inclusion committee.
Burning through this agenda, we don't have anything to report from that committee either.
One of those weeks. So outside meetings, council of governments, nothing to report there. OPRF community council now.
They had one of the requests at the beginning of the year when everyone was putting forth ideas of what to cover during the year, was a more user-friendly report of the budget, so they had the budget director come and talk about the budgeting process and explain it to the community council so that we can go forward and, you know, spread the good word about how OPRF comes up with its budget and where the funds come from and how they are resourced and dispersed. It's a very good way of explaining it, and perhaps they're working on ways to become more user-friendly in terms of information.
We'll be talking about user-friendly budget reporting later on in this meeting. All right, so that was community council. Youth Network Council, Stacy?
Youth Network Council met on Thursday, and the chief topic of conversation was the parent university that District 200 held, which was last week. And what it involved, it was a collaborative effort between the Mental Health Board, the District 200 Mental Wellness Collaborative, Success of All Youth, Positive Youth Development in the township. And it brought together a group of six different speakers to speak in three different time slots, and that was one of the things that I think they learned that they want to do differently in the future, because people had to choose between very valuable sessions. There was one on kids being overcommitted and overprogrammed. There was one on vaping. There was one on executive function. There was one on the teenage brain. And there was one on technology. And I attended two of them. And it was very well attended event for the kind of thing that it was. It probably had 160 people. And it's difficult to shake that many people loose for anything that's going on a weeknight. But there was quite a lot of interest in the topics. And I bring it up right now because it was a chief discussion topic at the Youth Network Council. One of the more, what I thought was probably the most important discussion of the evening, certainly the most important of anything that I sat in on, was the speaker that they had who was talking about technology. And I do not have his name, I should have gotten it before tonight, but he is on staff, he's a history teacher at D200. And he had an extremely interesting topic. Well, extremely. These were his materials that he offered to people who showed up. and it was extremely negative about the impact of cell phones and iPads and kids being able to be online when they are supposed to be in school. And the Youth Network Council had a rigorous discussion about it, and I'm always very proud to say that here in District 200, our kids do not have their cell phones with them during class time. 200 does allow them to have their phones with them. And the speaker talked about it being essentially impossible for kids to concentrate on actually learning something when their phone is right here and face down. And there was, he cited numerous studies where they had the phone here and face down, they had it in the bag, they had it hanging on a door in a pocket, and it was still distracting. The idea that it could be accessible, and you know how connected kids are, and the impact that that has on their ability to learn, was his main topic of conversation. And you know, being on the staff at 200, he is absolutely working to try to change that perception that it's okay for kids to have their phones in school. And apparently, according to D200 staff, parents were a major issue with this because they felt that their kids needed to have their cell phones all the time. And, you know, I was listening to the news, and two more school shootings today. And I'm sure that that is one of the main reasons why people think that their kids always need to be connected. But it does definitely present major problems and major, I think, mental health problems for kids. And that really was the main focus of the Youth Network Council conversation on the subject. So if anyone would like access to this, it's very interesting stuff. I wish I had picked up five more so I could give them to everybody, because he was widely distributing them, and there was a lot of interest in the subject. So I guess that is my chief contribution on Youth Network Council, and we also discussed it at the PTO Council with a similar level of interest. Am I failing to remember anything else we need to say about PTO Council?
There were a couple other presentations that were made. The administration talked a little bit about some of the curriculum initiatives, and there was an update on the strategic planning.
Right, which the PTO Council was very interested in having as much information as they could get. Of course, they're influencers, so we like to provide them with good information that then they can share within the community. So I think that's it.
I was at a meeting at OPRF the day that happened, so I wasn't able to go. But I think they said they were going to eventually put all of the information from each of the six sessions online.
I think they did say they were going to do that on the website.
Right,
and they, I also should, in reporting on that, say that they will be doing another session in the spring of Parent University, especially since it's been so well received.
And yeah, I think this one caught everybody off guard.
Well, I asked about that.
Didn't catch them off guard, but it was like...
Timing is always tricky.
The timing wasn't as good as it could have been, because like you said, it was a good program, and they could have had...
Well, and I think good word of mouth will bump it to the top of people's priority lists going around next time. You know, I think the fact that it was so worthwhile will bring in more people on the next round.
Well, I think at our last town hall on social-emotional learning, that was one of the major topics that was brought up, is social media, and... Parents want information on how to mitigate the negative impacts of social media. And I know that we've had at least three presentations sponsored by District 9 and the PTOs on screening and screenagers and advice for parents and resources that are out there. So I imagine, I hope that's something we can do.
We should talk about that. Barb, did they mention anything about the survey that has been put forth to District 200 parents about cell phones?
They did not.
Okay, because there is a survey now being circulated. I think also the students took it. faculty probably took it
no,
as well.
No, actually they did. And interestingly, what he said was that a lot of the negative information that they had about the impact was directly reported by the kids. You know, this was what they were saying about themselves, which, you know, is always interesting. So, but I know that there's an awful lot of conversation
yeah.
about it.
Yeah.
And we'll see what happens.
I talked to a child psychologist at Lori's, and she made a simple point, but it's not that simple. She said, how can someone get bullied on something that you could turn off? If someone's bullying you on your cell phone just or on an app, just get rid of it. But she said, but then she explained it's not that simple. There's a huge amount of input that goes in with it and things like that. But simply put, if this was like 1972 and you had a TV yelling back at you, you just turn it off and wouldn't even worry about it anymore.
But kids don't do that.
I know. That's what she said. It's I mean, it's a bigger thing.
There is no safe place anymore, really.
The negative impact of screens is evident here as I'm like going all over the agenda because I usually work off my paper copy, and so that's where I'm going to stick with from now on. Inclusiveness advisory board.
We met last Wednesday. It was the same night as the parent university, so we did not. I did not attend that, but. We had a pretty good conversation about the results from the Inclusive Advisory Board survey. There had been a team from the committee who kind of broke down the data and is looking at long-term trends and those things, but also what stood out from this year's survey results. And then we also discussed what is it called? The storytelling event? Is that
yes,
the storytelling
project.
Event project that is going to be in May that is replacing the One Book, One District program.
All right, thank you. River Forest Civic Association. Dr. Thompson, was there a meeting?
I have not had a recent meeting.
Citizen Core Council.
Putting together a pamphlet now for like a spring membership drive and just letting everyone know what they do and looking for participation from parents.
Did you attend the West Cook Governing Board meeting since the last?
Not since the last meeting.
Okay. Ed Red did send someone to the last. Oh, the next meeting is December 6th. River Forest Subcommittee on Collaboration.
I have reached out to other members of the subcommittee, and they are sort of a team in search of a mission. They are trying to figure out what else we could do that would be of common value and interest to the community. And so far, nobody has put anything forward, but I will continue to suggest that we not let that collaboration go because I do think that it has value. Positive youth development, I know the township did have a speaker here to talk about, I believe, suicide ideation. Amanda came over and talked about that. And they have an outstanding presentation on that. I was glad to hear that even on a very busy night, we had 25 parents or so here having a robust discussion on that subject. PYD also can offer presentations on vaping, and I know that there is lots and lots of interest on that, and all you have to do is listen to the news. There's something new on it every day. I think that's about all we need to say about what's going on with them right at the moment.
Great. District calendar review?
Yes, so hard to believe.
Tri-board.
I'm sorry, Tri-Board Equity Committee has not met, and
sorry.
There is no schedule.
So it's hard to believe that Thanksgiving recess is almost upon us. Schools will be closed Wednesday through Friday next week in honor of the holiday. Next time the board will be together is the December 3rd committee, the whole meeting. That's back, actually scheduled for this room at 7 p.m. And December 16th is the Board of Ed, last meeting before the end of the calendar year. Class is dismissed for winter recess on the 20th, 2:30 p.m.
Going by fast. All right. District meeting agendas, inclusiveness advisory board.
Yeah, I think Katie did a great job covering the waterfront on that. There was also an administrative update, but it was really a great focus on the survey from the data from the survey. And then, of course, Barb did a great job going over the district PTO council. So,
perfect.
The one thing that was mentioned that we want to stress publicly at the PTO council meeting was the forthcoming announcement of the strategic planning parent community engagement event. This event will be scheduled for December 11th, and the purpose of the event will be to garner feedback from parents and community members that will be used for the strategic planning process, and it will actually be held in this room that night. So Dawn, of course, has a whole communications plan around that that we'll be launching soon, but we wanted to get the word out on that wherever we could.
So action items.
Yes, so that brings us to the superintendent's report tonight. And you'll see, board members, that on the agenda, this really probably should have been renamed Finance and Facilities Meeting, because there's an awful lot of business in that area. The two action items tonight are resolutions, and I'd ask if he's willing, Anthony would maybe walk us through that.
Okay, thank you. If you go to page 87 of your board packet, you'll see the first action item is the resolution directing the school treasurer to partially abate and transfer monies from the working cash fund to the operations and maintenance fund. As per the board adopted budget back on September 23rd and our long-range projections prior to that, this $1.3 million transfer was anticipated and approved by you in that budget to cover the operating fund deficit in the operations and maintenance fund, which had to be had the items transferred to the capital projects fund. I know that seems like one A to B to C, but it's just the way that fund accounting works. The expenditures were expended out of the capital projects fund for all the work that was done this summer. The operations and maintenance fund transferred into that, in which at the end of this fiscal year in June, you will be approving a resolution approving all those transfers. You do that at the end of the year per the state statute. And this one is to transfer the money from working cash to cover those as well, just because there's not enough money in the operations and maintenance fund for those projects. And this was talked about, discussed, and adopted in your budget. It has to be done now, because that's one can't wait till the end of the year, because you need funds in the operations and maintenance fund throughout the year. Even though funds are commingled, you can't have an individual fund that goes below zero. So this, as you can see, there is almost $8.8 million in the working cash fund. It has the money to cover the 1.3, and I look for a motion to approve this resolution directing the treasurer to make that transfer.
Can I have a resolution directing the school treasurer to partially abate and transfer monies from the working cash fund to the operations and maintenance fund?
So moved.
Second.
Mrs. Avalos?
Yes.
Mr. Davis?
Yes.
Mr. DeGrassis?
Yes.
Mrs. Hickey?
Yes.
Mr. Moore?
Yes.
Thank you. I'll go into the next one. Page 89 in your board packet. This is the resolution regarding the estimated amount of taxes necessary to be levied for tax levy year 2019. As you know, the tax levy is brought to you for your approval before the last Tuesday in December, so you'll see that next month. Prior to that, though, not less than 20 days prior to that, you have to do an estimated levy, in which you see it right here. And this estimated levy is showing that a truth in taxation hearing is not needed at December, because the top portion of this, the first whereas, shows the prior year's extension for 2018, and then what we are estimating to be levied in 2019, and that amount is not more than 5%. Actually, it's just merely over 2%, which is the CPI was 1.9, and then we have to capture any new growth in, so it goes up a little more than that to try to capture any new growth in River Forest, so that now we're not leaving any money on the table. So with that, this resolution says, here is our prior year extension, here is our current year estimated levy. We do not need to have a truth and taxation hearing to pass the levy in December, but please pass this resolution for the estimated one now. So I'm looking for a motion.
Can I have a motion to approve the resolution regarding the estimated amounts of taxes necessary to be levied for the year 2019?
So moved.
Second.
Mr. Moore?
Yes.
Mrs. Hickey?
Yes.
Mrs. DeGrasse?
Yes.
Mr. Davis?
Yes.
Mrs. Avalos?
Yes.
Thank you. Judy, you'll have to stick around and sign some things.
I just figured that out.
I'd like to thank the administration for this is our first use of the administrative recommendation overview, which is the synopsis and of what's being asked for and the recommendation rationale. So I think that will help not only us but the public see what we're doing.
It was nice to start with that one out of the chute. It was a pretty simple one. So
for you, maybe
we do have several information items. Tonight, and of course, was mentioned earlier, November 15th of every year is typically reserved as the day in which we acknowledge the contributions made by our Board of Education members. This is typically done throughout the state. As a matter of fact, there's a proclamation from our governor. I can think of few community volunteer roles where so much is asked of individuals. And yet people are expected to be so responsive to their constituencies as that of a school board member. At heart, school board members, while elected, are volunteers. Would it were that they were paid, they'd be worth an awful lot, but they spend a lot of time away from family. They spend a lot of nights out, quite a few baked chicken dinners, and other kind of elements of the job. That
don't forget uncomfortable chairs.
Don't come with the glory.
Baked chicken,
yes. There's always another baked chicken dinner, as you know. So this evening, we do want to acknowledge them. Of course, the student performance would have been the best part, but we do have a certificate of appreciation for them. We wish we could do more. I sought out a quote because I wanted to say just the right thing. And everything that I found ended up being a rhyming poem. So I will spare you all of that. But there was one very, I thought, wise nugget that I wanted to just share publicly before we move on. And it was the definition of a volunteer. And I think of our board members when I read this. A volunteer is a person who remembers to do the things that make other people happy, who takes the loneliness out of the alone by talking to them, who is concerned when others are unconcerned, and who has the courage to be a prophet and say what has to be said for the good of all. And I think that's a reflection of the people we have bringing governance to our Board of Education. So we thank you all very much.
Thank you, Ed. Too kind, too kind.
The problem with this room is that it really echoes, doesn't it? We need more applause.
I will say, personally, and I imagine others share this sentiment that it's truly an honor to serve District 9 in this capacity.
And Friday is the convention.
Yes.
And none of us are getting sweets or expensing anything to the school district. We're all going down on our own and coming back home.
Green line?
Unlike most school districts.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I know.
So our second information item tonight is regarding operating fund financial projections. And this is one of the more important reports that we provide for board members each year, certainly around this time of year. So Anthony, I was hoping you could maybe walk us through this. I know you put a lot of time and energy into making this as accurate as possible.
Right.
So we appreciate maybe not only you're sharing some of the underpinnings, but kind of implications as the board is thinking about some expenses.
Sure. The format that you see starting on page 93 is very much like what you've seen before. However, when I get through this presentation, which goes all the way to about 122, I won't go over all those pages. I want to draw your attention to page 123, in which there'll be a second scenario, and we'll talk about that in a second. So this is the operating fund financial projections through 2024. You could say it's a five-year financial projection, but it's really a budgetary year and then four additional projection years. But that makes up the five. So it's listed by your operating funds, which are your education fund, your operations and maintenance fund, your transportation fund, and your working cash fund, thus your four operating funds. It's listed showing your budgeted receipts and projected receipts for each fund, as well as your budgeted expenditures and projected expenditures for each fund. It goes into some details, which I will gloss over very quickly, and then it talks about operating fund excess or deficits, in which the revenues over expenditures or the expenditures over revenues, which would be a deficit, and then the changes in the fund ending fund balance for those years. So on page 94, it talks about the significant assumptions. So when you talk about the education fund budgeted receipts, your main source of revenue is your property taxes. And those property taxes starting in fiscal year 2021 are projected using the appropriate CPI, or Consumer Price Index, of 1.9%. Property taxes for 22 through 24 are projected using a CPI of 1.7, which is the average of the previous 4 years' CPI. Once you get to these low numbers, the averages don't change that much since we haven't seen much more than 2.1% over the last few years. If you remember, you had a levy strategy when there was an educational fund tax rates ceiling for that individual levy. There was a strategy when property taxes were going down and the inverse relationship of the rate going up, we started shifting money into the special education levy, which is the same fund, just a different levy, in order not to hit that ceiling. Well, we're getting to the point now, once that a couple years ago that maximum was removed by the state, that we don't need to do that anymore. So you'll start to see projections that include a reduction in the special education fund tax levy from $1.703 million to $1.5 million in tax year 21. And you'll receive those monies in fiscal year 23. It's part of another levy strategy in tax years 20 through 22, or fiscal years 22 through 24, due to declining fund balances in the transportation fund, and the reason it's declining is because expenditures are exceeding revenues, that fund's tax levy will be increased by $450,000 each year, not compounding, just by $450,000 over it is now. And then finally, in tax years 20 and 21, or fiscal years 22 and 23, a life safety tax fund levy of $250,000 will be reintroduced to reestablish that fund to partially finance any identified and approved life safety projects. None of those things should be news to you. We've talked about them several times. As you know, we just had our 10-year life safety resurvey by our architect, who is compiling the final reports and submitting those to the state in the next couple of weeks. We will have a bond sale for life safety funds. You won't see that in here because the life safety fund is not an operating fund, but it'll be about $2 million, and then the 2 years of about $250,000 makes up about $2.5 million, which is what we see these life safety projects total. But we'll talk about that more when we do the long-range facility study facility report January or February. State aid is based on the evidence-based funding formula, where District 90 remains a Tier 4 district. As such, due to our adequacy percentage, we're only eligible to receive 0.1% of any additional funding from the state, which equates to about $1,400, so don't spend it all in one place in next year's budget. Federal aid is projected to remain steady through 2024. Education fund budgeted expenditures, the significant assumptions, the teachers' collective bargaining agreement that took effect in August of 2017 runs through the end of fiscal year 2020. So we'll be in negotiations. So salaries for 21 through 24 are shown using an increase of 3% with a CPI floor as used in the CPI floor with a CPI with a floor of 3, I'm sorry, as used in the current CBA. Salaries reflect approved retirement requests of veteran certified teachers, with replacement with new members with average salaries. We've included an additional 4.0 FTE in each year to account for one of the most recent proposals of the Roosevelt Block Schedule. That may change as that comes more to fruition, but we wanted to put something in here if that was affected in the financial side. Salaries for the remainder of the employees are projected using an average increase of 2.5. Remember, changes in enrollments, because they remain steady, are not factored in these projections. Employee benefits, you see what the 11.5% increase in insurance costs. We have two tiers in those insurance costs in our collective bargaining agreement, and that's still factored in. In addition, we continue to include the lowest reported potential pension cost shift, 1% annual increase starting in 2020. It's like to include any cost shift that will start with the base percentage and subsequently increase by 1%, so 2%, 3%, 4% over those 4 years. Purchase services and supplies and materials are projected when considering contracted professionals and any textbook adoptions. Transfers out are limited to our inner accounting transfers like one you did tonight. Operations and maintenance fund. Oh, before I go on, any questions about those assumptions for the largest of the operating funds?
Okay. You just said an increase of 1%, 2%, 3%. Do you mean that additional 1%?
Additional 1% every year.
Not an increase. Okay.
So, okay. Yes, because everything we've ever heard about a possible
pension fund. 1% of what we currently pay, which is nothing. So.
No, 1% of credible earnings. So that's the only thing we've ever heard that would be phased in.
Thank you.
Which would be up to what the normal cost is about 8.7% now, so it would take, under this scenario, 8 years to get there. But it could be anything, but you have it. Without any further information, that's the
right.
One of the assumptions I have. Operations and maintenance, budgeted receipts, the property taxes, also the largest revenue source, are projected using the same way as the education fund. And then any transfers in are allowable from the working cash fund necessary to cover operating deficits like you just did earlier tonight. Those expenditures for operations maintenance, salaries is the biggest one, projected using a 2.5% increase. Employee benefits, once again, using an 11.5% increase. Capital outlay is projected to fluctuate to coincide with the long-range facility plan. Transportation, remember this, the revenues for that, property taxes are based on the levy strategy that I mentioned in the first paragraph. Transportation fund expenditures fluctuate for transportation for special out-of-district children enrollment and continued absorption of any additional fuel charges. Working cash fund, same thing for property taxes. There is a bond proceed listed on here as your strategy of having working cash fund bonds to the extent possible every 8 or 9 years. Well, one of the fiscal year 23, remember the last time we did it was fiscal year 15, so that's been 8 years. So we put in $9.5 million of a bond sale since that follows the proper timetable. Prior to that, you have not only a partial abatement, but almost a complete abolishment of the working cash fund as required. Right before you sell working cash fund bonds, you need to zero it out or enough to meet the next bond and interest payment. Transfer it to another operating fund, in this case, Adder O&M, and then reestablish the working cash fund bond. For those of you that were around in 15, you know that's how we do it. And then working cash fund expenditures are just transfers that may need to be covered to cover operating fund deficits. So I'm going to skip all of the individual detail because there's wonderful graphs and bar graphs, but it's really all essentially what I just said. And I'm going to go all the way to page 121 in your packet. So this is one of the most important pages in this projection because it talks about the deficit spending, if there is any. And as you know from this year's budget in the operating funds, yes.
If you're looking at it on your screens, it's page 26 and 27, correct?
Yes, but the yes, correct.
Thank you. Because I don't see those. No, I apologize.
That's fine. Go ahead. That's fine. This is the projected excess of receipts and other financing sources over or under expenditures and other financing uses for the operating funds. You'll see it individually by fund, where we'll pull the revenues and expenditures from the other report tables and then total it. This year was the first year in many years that our expenditures exceeded our revenues in total in these operating funds. It was about $60,000. But due to all these projections, with all the assumptions I've read to you earlier, the projected deficit spending, meaning we will have to pull from reserves for fiscal year 21, is $1.18 million. Then that deficit grows in fiscal year 22 to $2.5 million. And in 23 to $3.0 million. Those are not, it means individually in those years, that is the deficit. So for those 3 years alone, that's almost That's about $6.6 million of deficit. So we used $6.6 million in reserves those 3 years. In the fourth year, because that is the year that we received the proceeds from the working cash fund bond issue, you see a positive amount. But if you did not have that bond issue that year, the deficit would be $3.7 million, or making a total of about $9.8 million of deficit spending over those 4 years. So I just want you to understand, because as you see on the next page, or page 27, that your projected fund balances for these four funds are $32 million, $29 million, $26 million, but then back up to $32 million, and you think, well, we broke even. But you only broke even because you issued $9.5 million in bonds. And this is, once again, nothing new. We've been talking about this for years. Any questions about those situations? Yes.
So if we have no CPI, maybe 1%, but our expenditures go up for some strange reason, transportation or something like that, within these years, would we have to do, would we have to have a public hearing if it goes up above 5%, right?
No, that's if the levy goes up by more than 5%. If you're asking for more than 5% of the previous year's extension.
Right.
Yes.
So at some point in time between 22 and 23, when we are exhausting our working cash flow, and that kind of, I'm just building like a worst case scenario type
right.
of thing, we may have to ask for...
No, and this is where I want you to understand the terminology. A truth in taxation hearing is merely saying you're asking for more than 5%.
Okay.
But without a referendum, you're in a tax cap district. You're in a tax cap county. You're not getting more than CPI plus new property growth. So you can ask for 100%. You're only getting 2.2% without a referendum. So the tax levy hearing in a tax cap society is really
a formality.
It's for those people that have a TIF coming off the roll or some large new growth where they say, if I just go up by 2%, I won't capture all that, so I need to go up by 11% to capture it. You have to have a hearing. Back in the day before tax cap, truth in taxation hearing was essentially saying to the board, if you're going to ask for more than 5%, you have to tell the people in the audience that you're asking for more than 5% because you'd have no cap. You can come in and ask for 50% more without a referendum, as long as your individual fund levies did not exceed their individual maximums. That's all changed since 1994. You've been in a tax cap. So now what your situation is, you're really never going to get more than 5% unless you have an extenuating circumstance like a TIF coming off the roll or you had a lot of new property growth. Well, in River Forest being landlocked, you're not going to have that. Well, I'm not saying you're not going to have that much new property. Back in 2009, or the tax levy year for 2009, when the town center TIF came off the roll, you asked for, and I don't remember the number, I apologize, it's been so long, but you asked for, let's say, 27%, just because you had to recapture all of that. It was $60 million of TIF assessed valuation coming off the roll. You had to have a hearing.
That's what's known as the balloon levy. You have districts doing the balloon levy.
Right. To recapture anything possible. We don't have that right now. There's no TIF coming off the roll. There's not a lot of new property growth. Therefore, there's no solution in these 5 years just by asking for more in a normal levy scenario that will get you more dollars. But good question. Any other questions? Okay, one of the things I want to mention in this entire through page, 27, there has been talk about a property tax freeze in Cook and Collar counties. And it's been talked about for many years. This is the first time that people are starting to wonder if it can actually be passed due to the fact that there are some capital improvement bills in the state of Illinois that need money to be funded. And the governor is promising that they'll be funded possibly with the income tax increase or reestablishment of the higher income tax. The only way to get that funded is to do that reestablishment of the income tax, and maybe the only way to get that passed is to offset a property tax freeze. I chose conservatively, and I know that seems backwards because if you're conservative, you want to show in a different way, but I didn't want to show a property tax freeze because there's no way to estimate how many years they would freeze it, whether or not we would be able to fall under, if they only did it for 1 year. There's a rule in the property tax levy formulation that says if you can go back to a previous year which has a higher extension as long as it wasn't more than 3 years ago. It was the algorithm to do it was probably too complicated, and I didn't want to sway any decisions you were going to make by showing too dire of a situation. So without any knowledge that there is going to be a freeze, this is without it. I'm only saying it if there is a freeze, this will look worse. Any questions before I move on to the second scenario, which is only changes in a few pages? Okay.
But if there's a freeze, there'll be a chain reaction of other things. We may be able to increase our working cash and things like that, right?
No, this just means that you don't get as many, you don't get to ask for...
Well, I understand that part, but I'm saying it's like they're just going to freeze it and say, okay, all you guys figure out where you're going to get more money from?
Yes.
Like your bills?
Yes.
It means we'll go into
larger deficits.
Yeah. Well, I understand that. But
yeah.
Okay.
It means...
Yeah. There's no solution to quickly fix a property tax freeze other than the fact that if it's only for 1 year for political reasons, you might be able to go and start with the second
right.
prior year's extension and start from that to increase. You really, really only lost 1 year instead of losing it into perpetuity because the lines are getting further apart. But no, there's no quick, I'll just pull it from here and I'll make up all those dollars I didn't get.
So it could mean we would accelerate deficit spending, and also the bonds that we issue might not
last as long.
Yes.
Correct.
But what about the school boards that are always in deficit spending and always living to the next tax payment?
Yes. Good thing you're not a school board member at that type of a school district.
Okay.
They don't get appreciation days at all.
There's no cuts.
No certificates.
Second,
no cuts.
Second scenario.
All right, so the second scenario, which is my page 123 and is your page 1 again, or no page, it just has a cover sheet. This is the same operating fund financial projections, but it includes the effects of a 2-year phased-in HVAC project in fiscal year 21 and 22. We've talked about this project before. The dollar amounts that were used were those that were distributed to you and discussed at the September 23rd board meeting that did not include the gymnasiums being air conditioned. So about $4.9 million. So rather than go through how it changes, because what it does, it not only changes the operations and maintenance fund, because that's where the dollars are going to come from, it will change the working cash fund, because transfers in from the working cash fund to cover those deficits will happen much quicker. And it will change the education fund as well, because the amount that's being transferred into the education fund right before you sell the working cash fund bonds in 23-24 will be less. So that's why you see education fund, operations and maintenance fund, and working cash fund differences. And I won't go over the individual statements unless you want me to. I'll go straight to page 6 or page 129. Matters what you have. So as you can see, the deficit spending now looks a little different, because there is $3.3 million in extra expenditures in fiscal year 21, and $1.6 million of additional expenditures in 22. And the reason why it's spread over 2 years is because we would never be able to do all three buildings in one summer. So we did it where there was a portion of it in the first year and another portion in the second. So the deficit spending in 2021 is $4.5 million. The deficit spending in 21-22 is $4.1 million. The deficit spending in 22-23 is no different, it's still $3 million. And the deficit spending, the difference in 23-24 doesn't look any different from before, because you still got $9.5 million in bond sale, and nothing else changed with the working cash fund. You just got rid of a smaller amount in 22-23. So it's the difference is, as you can see on page 7, is the fund projected combined fund balances, $29 million in 2021, all the way down to $27 million in 2022-23. Now, you've issued $9.5 million. That got you back up to $27 million. And then if you have continued deficit spending in either one of these scenarios, you can kind of estimate how long it would take for these numbers to start to get down to a concerning level to where you'd have to consider possibly going to a referendum or doing something else to cut expenditures. Because under the State Board of Education's budget rules, it's called the Budget Reconciliation Act of 2013, I believe, or 2011, when your combined fund balances in these operating funds is not three times your deficit in any one year, you have to present the State Board of Education with a deficit reduction plan. They don't want you just to go to referendum without trying something else first. Any questions about this scenario or these numbers?
So the question is the difference. I'm trying to pull it up on my dual screen system.
That's okay.
And compare the two. But that kind of magic year in either scenario where we have to do something, either cut the budget or go to referendum. What are those 2 years?
Well, without going past the 5-year financial projections, because we never go past 5 years, but if I had to just off the record, even though it's in public and on tape, wonder where this would be, you might start to think. Remember, these scenarios are only $5 million difference. And I hate to say only $5 million, but they're not that much different. They only have one piece of information that's different. It's the $4.9 million HVAC project. If you keep going at this deficit, you could probably expect to be in a situation where you will only have a couple of years left of combined fund balances in the first scenario in about fiscal year 28, and in the second scenario in fiscal year 27. And the reason why I use that time is because there are certain times you can go for a referendum. There are an election cycle. So it's always March and November of an even year and April of an odd year. So I
appreciate that you've said that in almost every for the past 5 years, anytime we've asked you to, you know,
go down
that road, and you know, in your role, you've said it just the numbers won't work past 5 years. So I appreciate that. But if we look at this, you're saying with the HVAC and without, we're looking at 27 versus 28, that we need to do something else to get rid of that
right.
That
and when
scenario.
You say, yeah, when you say something else. Those dates I gave you is probably when you should go to referendum. If you're going to do something else, it may take more time to implement something else. I don't know if you could wait until 27, 28 to do other things, but if
sure.
It came time per the future election schedule to go to a referendum, you're looking at the March of 2028 or April of 2027. Not to get too specific.
We do bond issue at 31 again, right?
Bond issue would be 31, 32, but you won't make it.
Right. So
if the referendum doesn't pass, or if there are budget cuts that don't equate to enough, you're in a whole different scenario.
So as far as facilities go, is there anything big after 27, or are we covering the big stuff from 20 to 24?
Well, the good news is there's two pieces of news there. One's good and one's not so good. The good news is that
you just call that bad.
Right. Well, when you hear it, it doesn't sound bad. It's just the way I phrase it. The good news is that you're about to embark on what could be $2.5 million of facility improvements per the life safety money. That's not even in here.
Right.
Okay, so that's good. We've done a lot of work, or you've done a lot of work since 2010, life safety and non-life safety. I would assume you could remember that and admit it and see it and acknowledge that there's been a lot of facility work. But these are aging buildings, and you know you have to do a lot more. But there's nothing in these projections in the operating funds. There's only about $600,000 in the capital expenditures under the facility plans that would make it in the operations and maintenance fund, because there's really not that much on the horizon besides the life safety work other than roof, a couple of roofs, some, you know, there's about four or five things that would make up that $700,000.
Barring anything.
Right, barring anything else. Right.
Something.
Now, remember, yeah. Now that was the good news. The bad news is you said, is there anything on the horizon past 2027? We have a five-year facility plan. That's more than 5 years away. Other than roofs, we can't predict what would happen in
right.
8 years from now.
Well, I mean, you sort of can, because there's some things you can, like aging of windows or, you know, there's...
Oh, I'm not saying it's impossible.
Right.
I'm just saying it's not something that we extend ourselves out that far.
Well, and to be fair, it's inevitable. It's just like your own home. A boiler will fail.
Right.
There will be a need for some expense.
So, I know this isn't a facility discussion, but the good news is that we've redone the boilers at Roosevelt over the last 10 years. We've redone the Willard boilers in 2016, and the Lincoln boilers are in the life safety plan. All the roofs are all on the schedule. Windows were all redone at Willard in 2015. The half of them were done in 2012 at Roosevelt, and the other half is on the life safety plan. And there's only a few at Lincoln that need to be done. So roofs, windows, boilers, you're in pretty good shape, or about to be.
Okay.
Good.
That doesn't mean there aren't other things that are yet to be identified.
But those are predictable big ticket.
Those are predictable big ticket.
Predictable.
Right. Well.
Forecasts. In yes. your list of things to do.
So, not all gloom and doom, just a little gloom. And if there's no property tax freeze, then this is what it'll look like, hopefully. And if there's not a pension cost shift in the next year, then we're 1 year better than we were this year, because there's a pension cost shift in here. If the other assumptions that I have in here don't come to fruition, then you're in great shape. Last year, my projections were $150,000 off, I believe, over $25 million. So, shame on me for not knowing that. But hopefully, you have insurance costs that are better than 11.5%. You know, I mean, there's things in here that, you know, are built in to avoid huge pitfalls. And this is used for one purpose and one purpose only, to see the cliff before you reach it.
Thank you, Anthony.
Yeah.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm glad gloom is in your job description and not doom.
Well, one thing I would share as we move on is that the years Anthony just spoke to, all assumptions staying as is, you know, and I realize that you went out on a limb a little bit there for us, Anthony, in doing projections. We know it's not best school finance practice to do that. But,
and it's on audio tape, which doesn't make me happy.
You know, 2028, if that were to come to pass, that would have been 22 years, over a generation, since District 90 would have had some type of operating referendum. And everyone, of course, is eager to forestall that as long as possible, but that's quite a run. So anyway, I'm grateful. I know the board certainly is grateful to you, but as a colleague administratively, we're very grateful for the attention to detail you bring to this, and certainly helpful in terms of knowing what to expect.
Thank you, Anthony.
Sure. And any questions, email, call, anything. Okay.
So our next information item is pertaining to the Community Works Renewable Energy Letter of Commitment that was sent to us from the Oak Park River Forest Community Foundation. You're probably aware Community Works is an arm of the Oak Park River Forest Community Foundation, and they have three different main priorities. One has been the success of all youth. The second is around the Leadership Lab, or the Community Leadership Program, it was formerly known. And the third is sustainability and the work of Planet Green. In the 2011 sustainability plan, which was approved by the Village of River Forest and several other entities, and the 2018 Community Sustainability Report Card, There's a lot of focus on the importance of renewable energy. And many of the entities in both Oak Park and River Forest are making a commitment that within a reasonable period of time, based upon what that entity can handle in terms of the transition, they will transition over to the use of 100% renewable energy. For some entities, that could mean installing something like solar panels. For others, it could mean making a decision to acquire their energy through providers that source energy through renewable sources. We're presenting the board this evening with the letter that the Oak Park River Forest Community Foundation sent, asking that District 90 consider signing as an early adopter a letter of commitment to achieve 100% renewable energy in accordance with the timeline and projections established by the panel on climate change, which are referenced in the letter that they sent. Anthony and I have talked about this, obviously, as director of facilities and finance. He's aware that there could be implications. It would be hard for us to tell you how viable that would be within a certain period of time without us, you know, going down the path of contacting energy providers. But we can share that one of the neighboring school districts in Oak Park and River Forest has just recently signed an agreement that not only was a commitment to use 100% renewable energy over time, but also will accompany a cost savings. So we're very pleased, obviously, to look into that and try to provide you with some more firm information. This evening, as you know, it's just an information item. We did want to ask that, you know, you would consider it and feel comfortable to ask any questions you have. But our recommendation would be that we go forth, try to garner some numbers, and then bring them back to you in advance of your making a final decision as to whether that's a commitment that you would want to make in the best expenditure for, you know, the taxpayer dollars that we have.
I think that's a good idea. And of course, you know, renewable energy and using, you know, sustainable products and resources and systems is a goal.
It's in your strategic plan, your current plan. Yeah, and of course the partnership that District 90 has had with Green for Good, which is an amazing parent community and student presence in our school community, has been really powerful. So we think this has a lot of merit and is a great opportunity, but we wanted your blessing to go forth and gather some more information.
And so it's an informational item where it's not an action, but I think I would
go forward. No,
all right. We will do it. Anthony's going to share a little bit about the updated resident-friendly financial reporting instrument.
Hold on. I'm doing my recording
take
secretary
your other hat
duties.
Off and put
right.
The,
no, hold on. Yeah. So if you go to page 1 of 6 or page 145 of your board packet, you'll see what looks like last year's resident-friendly. Definitions have not changed. We still have, remember, the operating funds that I just spoke about in our long-range financial projections. And I've added a year, dropped off the 10th year, and this shows a 10-year historical trend of these areas that I'm going to discuss. So page 2 of 6 shows the operating funds revenue by source for the last 10 fiscal years. And remember, this combines, this resident-friendly reporting instrument combines all of the various reporting products that we have at our disposal and puts it into this one format. So this information comes mainly on this page from our comprehensive annual financial report. And it shows our local revenues, state revenues, and federal revenues as a percent of the total, and then shows how that changes over the 10 years and how it's adjusted for inflation using not the CPI but the employment cost index. Since we have a choice to use a different measurement, we choose to use the employment cost index, which is based more for industries or in the service industries, so where salaries and benefits are your largest expenditure. So this was updated per those employment cost index numbers adjusted for $630.19 dollars, because this is as of fiscal year 19. This is not budgeted numbers for 20. This is actual figures on our comprehensive annual financial report for fiscal year 19. And you can see our local sources are 90.4% of our total. Our state sources are 6.9% of our total, and our federal sources are 2.7% of our total. Not very much different than any of the previous 9 years. Very consistent. And of those, that 90% of local sources, taxes are 85%. So it's really property taxes across all these four funds. There wasn't a significant increase or decrease from the prior year and this year, so in the notes, those revenues are not shown as an indication of why any change happened. The next page shows operating at funds expenditures by object for the last 10 fiscal years. And that is a bar graph, as you can see, in which it talks about salaries, benefits, purchase services, supplies and materials, capital outlay and other, and their percentage of the 100%. As you can see, salaries are 61.6 and benefits are 14.9, essentially 76.5%, as we've been saying all along, about 76% of your total operating fund budget is salaries and benefits. The pie graph down below, none of this has changed from a previous year in terms of the presentation. It shows how it's broken down by function, how instruction, pupil support, instructional support, and the others. Though I reference those three because those three areas, which make up about 72% of your total actual expenditures, are those expenditure functions that are either directly associated with the classroom instruction or have the highest impact on supporting or enhancing classroom instruction. So it's good to know that over 70% of your expenditures do that. Page 4 of 6 shows those operating fund expenditures over those last 10 fiscal years and how they've been affected by the employment cost index or adjusted for inflation. And as you can see, there is no significant change in the prior year, so that was there was nothing about 2019 discussed. Everything else that you've seen in these notes, you've seen prior in the prior year resident friends. Excuse me. The average teacher salary for the last 10 fiscal years, and for those of you who have been around a long time, this was one of the reasons for this presentation, because we wanted to show how we compare with our other comparable high-performing school districts, 16 districts in the West Suburban Consortium for Academic Excellence, plus another northern suburban schools. I think there's six more that make a total of 22, us being included in that 22, which we consider comparable high-performing districts. So it talks about our certified teaching staff, which hasn't changed much from the prior year, our percent holding a master's or higher, which is at 84%, not much different from the prior year, but down a little bit since we've hired some bachelor's level teachers in the past few years who have not yet reached their master's level. And then the average teacher salary comparing to the other high-performing districts, the average of those 22 districts is about $74,000, and District 90 is just right around average, as it's been most of the time I've put this information together. It's been either a little bit below or a little bit above average. The change in fiscal year 19's average teacher salary was due to a calculation formula by ISBE per the 2019 report card metrics, which not only modified the numerator and the denominator, but the minimum salary amount eliminated from the average was raised. So what they do is they put together a whole listing, and then they drop off a certain dollar amount. Well, that drop-off point was raised, thus making things higher. So the average salary went up a bit, and that was the explanation. The operating expense per pupil on the last page, 6 of 6, this is a calculation of about a 75-line calculation on your annual financial report, in which it talks about various revenues, less many expenditures, and it comes out with an operating expense, and then you take it, divide it by the average daily attendance, getting with an operating expense per pupil. The sole purpose of this calculation is so that you can compare to dissimilar districts from various parts of the state, because the formula is exactly the same for all of the districts. So the dollar operating expense per pupil for District 90 for fiscal year 18, because it's always a year behind in the calculation, was $16,114, and comparing it to the other 21 high-performing districts, the average of that above was $16,460, and River Forest was right at the 50th percentile. Did not increase by a significant amount, therefore there's nothing in the notes. You see our student enrollment by building and district, as well as the student enrollment in total over the last 10 fiscal years, and you see it's steadily rising since 2015. Any questions at all about this?
Is there anything that, do we have any openings? Is there, there's a teacher shortage, and I have friends in other districts that like have empty classrooms, not empty classrooms, but they're, I mean, do we have a shortage issue?
Yes, I think virtually every district in Illinois is experiencing challenges sourcing high-quality candidates for positions. We had one position that was very difficult to fill this fall and lingered into November. But you're right, there are some school districts that are having an even harder time, some of them in West Cook, school districts in the southern part of the state, anything south of I-80 is really struggling. Most rural communities are at a loss. There are a lot of reasons for it, but there's been some recent legislation to try to curtail it, but the bottom line is that the pipeline is a big part of the problem. And so even with legislative changes, it's going to take some time to resupply a lot of the decrease that we've seen over the last 6 years.
But we're doing better than most.
By the time it comes home to D90, you know that the problem is substantial statewide. There are school districts downstate that have been dealing with this issue now for 5 or 6 years, and it's been very pronounced. So it's urgent.
And the shortage is mostly in kind of niche classrooms where endorsements or several endorsements are needed versus your core area, which is what the report's missing. So if you need LBS certification, special ed, those areas are more challenging to fill than others.
Thank you, Anthony.
Thank you.
That's very helpful. That document, I think, is particularly valuable for community members, maybe who aren't really aware of the workings of the school and can access a lot of information in a pretty concise way.
Yeah, that will be posted on the district's website under the district finances tab in the next couple of days. It will be replacing the one that's currently there.
The next information item pertains to strategic planning. I know we have a couple of people in the room who are already familiar with the information we're sharing. And for the board members, it starts on page 151 in your packet. We just wanted to provide some documentation regarding the progress that's being made so far. And, you know, in your packet, you have an agenda for our opening orientation session that was held November 12th. It was held in this room, and it was a great chance to kind of kick off discussions about what the strategic planning process would look like. You'll see that we included a copy of the participant handout. And it's very important, not only to the strategic planning facilitator, but to the team as a whole, that they feel like you as the board are being kept up to speed on the work that they're doing. We will be hosting the data retreat at the beginning of December, and that's the first full day session. It's actually going to be held off-site. We'd like to thank our community partner, Dominican University, for letting use one of their spaces for a very, very affordable cost. And basically what will happen at that event will be that team members will have the chance to hear three different presentations from district administrators and school administrators about the state of D90 as it is today. They'll be learning a little bit about our finances and facilities. They'll be learning about academics. They'll be learning about our school climate. And the goal will be that that will serve as a precursor to a discussion, a SWOT analysis. Basically a discussion of opportunities that District 90 might have to grow and continue to move forward. So that's the first main full-day event. Outstanding participation. We have a nice cross-section of participants from throughout our community, everything from faculty, staff, administration, Board of Education, community members, parents, students, the graduates, but high school students went through D90, actually attending a couple of different high schools. So we're off and running. More information to come.
That's a good point, different high schools. I think the last time we had just kids from OPR. All right.
So the next information item, right, it's regarding classroom learning environment. And I know that you had shared, Rich, that you were kind of hoping the board could have a chance to talk a little bit about follow-up on the conversation regarding HVAC that the board had in September, was it?
Yes.
Or October, September. Okay.
September.
Yes, September. Judy wore a winter coat, I believe, September, when we're talking about HVAC.
Oh, yeah.
yes, and so we have been talking about air conditioning since I've been on the board, and we were very close to it 5 years ago, I believe, my first year. And you know, I think everything I'm about to say, I think it was said at that last meeting when you presented potential cost for HVAC in all three schools, minus the gymnasiums, and that the cost was definitely lower than the cost was 5 years ago, and that's mostly or partly due because of the $1 million that we spent on improving our
univents.
Our univents.
Less so.
Yeah. And so I have said several times, you know, in this forum that I believe that air conditioning is a necessity. I think that I would like to see us move forward with air conditioning. I just want to kind of throw out some things there that most other school districts that are out there that I know of have all air-conditioned schools. I'm sure we can find a few districts that don't. But some of our more high-achieving school districts have many elementary school and middle school buildings that are cooled. I know $3-4 million is nothing to sneeze at, and I know it's challenging to ask for this, but I think there are so many benefits for cooling our schools, and I just want to kind of open it up to what the other board members think.
I think it is something that inevitably has to happen. It was somewhat reassuring to hear that whether we do it or not, it really only puts a year difference between when we would maybe need to go to referendum. I think it has been discussed here many times before that it's undeniable that it impacts student learning, it impacts teacher morale, there's health risks for many students and teachers with the temperature that it gets in the classroom, and the number of hot days is going to increase. So I think it is something that is valuable to consider.
And so what would, I mean, without us all having to go around the room, what would be the next steps then to move forward with this? I think at the last one, if we move forward with getting, putting this out to bid or getting the real number commitment by a company to do this, if it came in way higher than your tentative estimate, that you know we obviously could pull back.
Right.
So moving forward to get the real numbers, what are the and I don't want to inhibit anybody from saying whatever they think. But
I think it's a good idea because it would help the Spanish immersion program in the summer.
Learn their
Spanish.
I thought it was
Korean. Spanish, Korean, Japanese, language immersion in the summertime. I think it's a great idea.
My only issue with it is that if we do that, what do we then not be able to afford to do? I know we're going to have additional expenses, certainly with the block scheduling proposal coming up. I know that you have projected some of that to the extent that we can, but I think it does represent a very significant unknown. Anytime we're talking about more people, it is a big deal. And I see no reason not to get the specific information, but I do think that anytime you're talking about spending a big chunk of money, you have to look at what else is coming, what else do we... If we do that, what do we not do?
I agree with you on those fronts, but I also think that as we're getting these pieces of information and the block scheduling situation kind of finalizes it, we'll have more information about those costs, and certainly we will have have that information to make a decision about what we find out about their conditioning. I also think that we're doing a disservice to not move forward with at least investigating what it would
be. I have no problem with investigating.
Yeah.
Understand, and I'm not saying anything other than the facts. This isn't a feeler. I mean, this is going out to public bid. There's costs associated with it. Understand, this is an engineer coming in and engineering this product, going out to public bid and accepting those sealed bids and holding a public bid opening. There are costs, so there are architectural and engineering fees associated with that,
which we pay whether we decide to go forward or not.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Is your point.
Yeah. You're paying, right? So this isn't saying you're not floating a hot air balloon.
We're serious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Just wanted you to be, because I kept hearing, "Let's investigate, investigate." You're really not investigating. You're going forward. You're doing the work
costs.
To incur the costs to possibly have the project, and only saying no if the costs come in too high.
You know, and I know this is just another vignette, and we all have our stories about, you know, our kids in the schools. And it really was, you know, getting my son a clarinet, and the other fourth grader next to us was telling his mother that, guess what? What's his name did today, or what's her name? Because I don't want to divulge any identity here. During reading time, he went to sleep because he was so hot, you know. And so that's the kind of thing. I do believe that learning is affected, you know, and can be affected positively if we have more temperatures.
So to answer your question, it sounds like Anthony did a bit of that, but essentially it would be the board's consensus that you wished to have us proceed and garner the information Anthony described. The bid process, embarking upon the bid process, is one thing. You would be approving the project, so to speak, if you approved a bid.
Correct.
And so that would be, you know, no vote is necessary tonight. Obviously, that's just us doing our due diligence and coming back to you then with, you know, what would be the most competitive bid for the work that is being sought. It takes some time to do that. I suspect it would be 6 weeks, would you guess, Anthony?
I can't predict what the architect and engineer or mechanical engineer would take to do that. I can say that in order to get competitive bids on projects like this with lead times for chillers, I mean, you're going to have a cooling plant on the roof here at all three buildings probably. Other univents that need to be replaced that were not replaced last year, like at Lincoln, in which you recommissioned all of those old univents, and now you're going to replace those. So there's some lead time on that. I don't have it in front of me. I apologize. I should have done this when you accepted the bid for the HVAC project last year, but it was probably around January.
I would guess.
Right.
And your price is going to be more competitive the earlier you go out.
Right. So this is something where if you come to consensus that you want to do this, this would start immediately. And we would hope to have something put together so that you can accept a bid in January or February just because of that. So your consensus means that we make some phone calls in the next couple of days.
We would probably strongly recommend that if you proceed with this, the work be phased. We would recommend that if you proceed, it would very likely be Roosevelt first for several reasons. You know, we would be working with a vendor that we'd not, or a contractor we'd not worked with before, potentially. And if we're going to do it over two summers, it's probably better and easier to work with one site right out of the chute. You know, you have more square footage in this building. You also have probably...
You have more air conditioning right now in this building.
A percentage in this building is anywhere in the district. But and the most viable project.
And just to be clear, you'd be bidding out, if you phased it, you'd be going to bid for, and we chose Roosevelt first. Roosevelt. This isn't we bid out all of it and phase it over 2 years. I know the most economical would probably be to do the one project, bid that, and go out to bid again the next year. Generally, you get much high inflated numbers from a contractor if they know they're phasing it over multiple years because they're building in a higher cost of living or a higher increase because
things they don't know.
Right. The unknown. When people bid it on a year that you're in, they use the actual dollars that they expect to cost.
And it's building invasive work because the project that you're contemplating is doing the work properly. This is going to require a substantial team all of the summer that we have.
You'll be canceling summer school at Roosevelt.
At Roosevelt. We would likely be reassigning it to the elementary schools.
Right.
That's correct.
So then, given that rationale, and this has the most air conditioning, why wouldn't we do the elementary schools first?
I think for the reason that Dr. Conant said.
It's the lowest risk.
Right, to start with the one.
Yeah.
We're not entirely sure what companies will be responsive to this. And so, while we have experience with a contractor recently who assisted us with the Univent project, and they did an excellent job, we don't have experience with a contractor to do this specific work. We've never really done it. We have had HVAC work done in all of the buildings as part of other renovation work, but not as a standalone HVAC project.
And the work that was done last summer, while it was done to our specifications, they're still working out some of the kinks of the heating season, and because the building automation system isn't fully operable. So I wouldn't just say, hey, give it to those guys, or let's see what they say. I think this deserves a widespread public bid.
Right.
Well, and it's obviously mandated by the Procurement Act, but the other thing that, if that were to come to pass, would allow, and the project unfolded the way the board wished, would allow completion of the project at Roosevelt next summer, and then a full 9 months to prepare to launch the work at the elementary schools, as opposed to just the 5 months or so that we likely will get in advance.
So you've done some major facilities projects before, I'm getting. So, okay, done this before.
But any kind of migration or change management type of effort, you always do the pilot project is the lowest risk one. So.
Sounds good. So do we have consent? I wholeheartedly want to move forward, so do we have consensus then?
Almost.
I know that Dr. Thompson, Stacy are not here, but do we have consensus for us to move forward?
I'm a yes.
It's not an action.
You don't need a voice vote. Okay.
Okay.
Okay, we'll proceed.
Great.
We'll come back to you with what we find as soon as practical. The last information item that we have tonight is around the concept of educational foundations. And Rich and I had, I think, a really informative meeting with Susan Glover, who is an attorney with one of Board of Ed's law firms from Robin Schwartz. And she has a good deal of experience with the creation of educational foundations. We wanted to come to the board this evening with some information about those. In the packet, you'll find a memo from her that explains how foundations can be established. She talked with us about how school districts in many communities will establish foundations as 501c3s. There are a couple of different ways they can be structured, but they serve as a vehicle by which school districts can garner resources for many different reasons. In some communities, they're for facilities. In some communities, they're for established priorities like the arts or teacher grants. Our conversation with Susan was pretty specifically about how that could be done in the River Forest community to support facilities projects. But again, we wanted to just bring that information back to you and then answer any questions you might have. Rich, is there anything you wanted to share about the meeting that was particularly important?
No, the concept behind the foundation, we all get solicited by local foundations here, and you may donate to certain foundations, and I'm sure we all do. The concept is the best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago. And so had we had a foundation 20 years ago, maybe this HVAC project could be paid for, or some of that cost could be mitigated through foundation funds. And so the idea is that we have a foundation dedicated toward facilities improvement, I guess would be kind of one focus of a foundation for District 90.
So really, if it's right, you're kind of introducing the idea this evening, and then would probably come back to the board to get, you know, after they've contemplated it, maybe a more expanded kind of either information or presentation or something like that, so that you could solicit their direction.
Where my brother lives in California, you know, they have that proposition, whatever, that keeps the property taxes relatively low there.
13.
And all of the higher performing school districts there have their own foundations, and it's like a major operation yearly to raise basically
the balance.
Yeah.
I don't think it's that uncommon in Illinois either, though. I mean, I think we were at a swim meet in Brookfield Riverside this weekend, and they had their information about their foundation, their school district foundation. And also the elementary school I attended, or the community I attended school in many, many years ago, had an education foundation when I was there. So I think it's about time we have something like this.
Does it take away from the PTA?
Well, it's a great question. Like so many things, the way you structure it is really important, that such that you get the outcomes you're seeking. So, and what it even looks like, whether it's going to be basically a repository for contributions, whether it's going to be an active foundation that does fundraising or social events, whether it seeks out corporate contributions. Of course, obviously, the more elaborate that it is, or the more that it's going to do, the more you need people to coordinate that. Typically, there's a private board. There are different ways that those folks can be identified and solicited to participate, depending upon the structure that you set up. There are foundations that are entirely independent of the school district and function as their own entity. There are others that, depending upon how you build them, that fall under the umbrella of the school district, but both of those offer different opportunities and limitations. So
it probably should be said that in a community as small as we are, if you're looking at putting together a foundation, you're going to be drawing from a wonderful pool of talent, but a small one. If people are running the PTOs, they are unlikely to also be involved in the foundation. If people are involved in, you know, you can only go so deep one of my concerns. And I, you know, you just would have to structure it very thoughtfully so that you were able to get the quality of leadership that was able to accomplish what your goals are without weakening the structure that otherwise upholds an outstanding district.
Sure, and I think just going right to the PTO that does so much and contributes so much, and that we're all probably on a committee for, you know, when students leave, you know, this is a way that people can still stay connected to a school district that, you know, served them, served our family so well. And I think that's part of the vision.
This has a much broader reach than just the PTO. Residents who do not have kids in the district anymore, at least from the way I've seen them operate in the past, have a larger role in an education foundation than
that's a good argument to do it.
Mm-hmm. President to deepen Oak Park Education Foundation for many, many years, Debbie Abramson, mm-hmm. who had children go through District 97 at one point, but you know, for many, many years her children were grown and flown out mm-hmm. of there. So
yeah. I just went to school with my neighbors in Yeah, but that's, you know, that is something to think about in how you would want to structure it and how you would want to recruit for it.
Sure.
Well said. Yeah, I think that was probably
to think about.
That was probably the one thing that Susan stressed more than anything, is the intentionality of how you build it. Because if you
how you build it, what its goals are.
Exactly.
You know, what you intend for it to do.
Well, it sounds like we have a lot of people on this board that know a lot about it, so that's good.
Many right. hands make light work.
We need that enthusiasm and knowledge. Okay. Upcoming, well, that's it on the agenda. And there's no personnel? Wow. Upcoming meetings, Committee of the Whole, December 3rd. Business meeting on December 16th. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone.
And,
can I have a motion to adjourn?
Mrs. Avalos?
Yes.
Mr. Davis?
Yes.
Mrs. Diagrafo?
Yes.
Mrs. Hickey?
Yes.
Mr. Moore?
Yes.